I kind of want to dispute your version of that story, but you're making me question my manner with bartenders because I
No.
didn't
I thought it
think
was
that I was.
very friendly. No, it was
Okay.
very friendly, but it was challenging. I felt like you were challenging
Was
him.
it?
Yes, I did. I did. I did feel like you
To be
were.
fair, this bar that we went to was like a secret bar, like a real speakeasy thing. And their whole deal was that they made classic cocktails and really
Yes.
knew how to do it.
It was a bar that used to be Milk and Honey. It's now called Attaboy. And I spent a lot of time there in my early raggedy ass 20s, because that was my neighborhood. And I made Rebecca go there. And I don't think you were rude about it at all, but I liked that you were like testing.
I didn't think of it as testing. I thought of it as that's what they do here. These are people who are supposed to know their cocktails. So I felt comfortable just going in and saying, I'll have a bee's knees.
Right.
And also knowing that the bee's knees containing honey syrup is something that I would be hesitant to order if I weren't pretty confident that they would do it well, because I don't like very sugary sweet cocktails.
Right.
Yeah, and then I also had him concoct me a recipe from, remember the Isla Scotch?
Yes.
That was good too. Do you remember what was in it? Because it was, I know it was mint, lime, aromatic bitters, and Isla Scotch, but I couldn't remember if there was something else. Listeners, if this sounds like a familiar cocktail to you and you want to fill me in on what the recipe might have been, I would love to hear it. Hi, I'm Rebecca Cohen.
And I'm Maya Garance.
And this is The Sauce, the culture and politics podcast where we drink cocktails and ruin the stuff you love.
You know, the world is ending, so we're going to talk about Oscars.
Yes, listeners, we are going to talk about the Oscar nominations. We want to go through the various categories, not every single one, and share some of our thoughts and also our thoughts on some of the movies that were nominated. But before we get to that, we're going to do our usual thing. We're going to check in, see how everyone's doing. We want to talk a little bit about some of the stuff going on in the news
Oh, yeah.
and stuff like that. So let's start with how we're doing. Maya, how are you doing?
Am great. I am on an artist residency in Charlotte, North Carolina, at the McCall Center for the Arts. Everyone, pro tip, if you're gonna go live somewhere for long enough that you're gonna be cooking for yourself, bring your own knives. Bring
Oh,
your own
that is a
knives.
good tip.
God, I should have known that coming in, but I've already injured myself on the very dull kitchen knives that they have. So if you guys want to mail me a really nice, sharp kitchen knife with a nice weighted handle, or if you want to mail me something like a little mixing something, a little shaker,
What
just.
about a moonstone so you can sharpen the knives?
Oh no, these are like so cheap. They're
Oh,
not even, yeah,
okay.
that's a
Maya
waste. That's
needs
a waste.
knives.
I need knives and I need like a cocktail shaker. So if you want to send that, send it care of the
Oh.
McCall Center
Well,
and I'll receive it.
if you don't have a cocktail shaker, what are you drinking?
I am drinking a sort of daiquiri that I made with, I learned that 3 tablespoons is 1 jigger.
That's a good thing to know.
Another thing that's interesting that I remember from when I lived in the South is that liquor, hard liquor, is not sold in grocery stores here. It's sold in
Yeah.
ABC stores.
Yeah, different states have different things. Like there's ABC stores down there. In Connecticut, they call them package
That's
stores.
what they call them in Mississippi.
See, for me, I've been living in New York for a while. They don't sell liquor in the grocery stores here either. But California is a little spoiled in that way. Like, you can go into the drugstore, you can go into Walgreens and buy a bottle of vodka.
But New York has like liquor stores, lots
Yes,
of them.
true.
Charlotte is the biggest, one of the biggest cities in North Carolina. It's like a massive banking center or whatever. But the number of stores where you can buy hard liquor are actually quite limited. But
Oh, wow.
there are not many of them, but they are stocked as shit, let me tell you.
Oh,
Because
well, that's great.
if there's not going to be that many liquor stores, the ones that do exist are going to be enormous, like an entire wall of rums.
That's Wonderful.
It's impressive. It's impressive.
I mean, I could spend all day in a store like that. So tell me again what's in your daiquiri.
It is some Appleton rum, lime, and a simple syrup that I made with honey and not sugar because that's what I have in my apartment.
That sounds very nice. It's a very traditional daiquiri in a lot of ways.
Very traditional. Now, you were making your cocktails. We were planning this, and I heard you talking to yourself about how you didn't believe the recipe. What are you drinking?
Okay, so I'm drinking a Scofflaw because my new affectation is only drinking cocktails from the 20s because it's the 20s.
Oh, so good.
Thank you. Well, you also were drinking a cocktail from the 20s. The traditional daiquiri was very popular in the 20s, though the recipe may date back a little bit before that. The Scofflaw is rye, vermouth, fresh lemon juice, grenadine, a little bit of orange bitters, shaken and strained into a cocktail glass. It's all right. What you heard me muttering about was that the recipe called for a quarter ounce of fresh lemon juice and a half an ounce of grenadine, which I found to be implausible. Like, why so much grenadine? A whole ounce of dry vermouth. It's just really interesting proportions. I want to trust it. I should just trust the recipe. I can't drink anything that's going to turn out that red. But I had to do something with fresh lemon juice because we had people over and I sent Matt to buy fresh limes and lemons. And I told him, get a lot. He came home with a dozen of each. And I mean, we must have used two of each at the party. So I have all of these lemons and limes. What am I going to do with them?
What you're going to do is you're going to squeeze the juice and freeze them in ice trays.
Okay. Yeah.
And then you have frozen cubes of lemon and lime juice that you can defrost to make your cocktails with.
That's a wonderful idea. Listeners, look at these helpful tips you get.
You know what I really like about Rebecca's new affectation is I got to watch it in action because I was in New York over the new year and Rebecca and I went out drinking two nights in a row, which was pretty fucking rad.
Yeah, and it was like New Year's Day and the day after. So we had been celebrating New Year's Eve. I was drinking like three nights in a row. Actually, maybe more than that. It's kind of a blur, but
well, we had a wonderful time.
We
and
did.
I just feel bad. We took no pictures to share with you guys.
It was a moment just for us. No, I thought about it. I was like, we could Insta this. We could do a live video. It'll be like a live podcast on Instagram. But I said no. How rare is it that I get to see Maya face to face? That we can actually enjoy our cocktails in the same room. I just wanted to enjoy that. But it was lovely. It was so great to get to see you. And now you're in the same time zone with no kids around and no responsibilities except to do art, to make art.
Yeah.
You have your room of one's own.
I have a giant room of one's own. You can hear the echo. Forgive the echo for the next. Yeah, forgive the echo for the next couple of months. Charlotte, I gotta say, and like no offense to any Charlotte listeners, but it's kind of a basic bitch of a city.
I can imagine. I've never been.
It's the sort of place where the second a building gets just even just a little bit like 10 years old, they just tear it down. They just like, there are zero old buildings here. It's kind of weird.
Is it like kind of strip mallish?
Everything is strip mallish, but it's also like even the strip malls get torn down after 10 years. There isn't any like, oh, we keep this building because, oh, it's what we were like in the 20s. It's like tear the shit down, just tear it down. Also, but except for one bar that ended up being kind of this hometown hero bar, which is called The Thirsty Beaver. I know. I'm getting you a t-shirt.
You better.
And
Thank you.
Thirsty Beaver is like a white trash biker bar. And what's amazing about it is that when the people, you know, building all the strip mall condos wanted to tear it down to build those apartment buildings, they sort of collected money and like got everybody in the town involved and they managed to survive and they kept a hold on their space. And so then the housing development, the apartment building just built around them like the house and up.
That's amazing.
It's amazing.
Is it still a divey bar?
Oh yeah. Oh, it certainly is.
It's wonderful.
It's a divey bar. They pour really strong, simple drinks in plastic cups. And there are two pool tables in the back. The jukebox is very heavily country music, except for the occasional random like punk album. It's quite awesome. The Thirsty Beaver is the shit. Like, I am all about Thirsty Beaver.
See, you can find those little magical places, those spots, in even the most basic of towns.
I still don't have the emotional capacity to talk about Australia, and so I'm not going to. But I feel like Lev Parnas basically singing like a songbird.
Oh, yeah.
I just can't get over this moment where everything is so explicit and it's exactly what we thought it was and it's as horrible as we knew it was.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't seem to be shifting the needle in this bigger way. Like, it's so bad. It's so bad.
It's very bad.
It's a gangster movie. It's nuts.
Yeah, I mean, it's really causing me to contemplate, as much as I have already been doing so, it's making me contemplate even more so this question of, like, are we past a point of no return here? Are we?
Yeah.
How far gone are we? Because I think that there's just a general principle in all realms that when you have norms and standards and any kind of rules that are only enforced because we all agree they're rules, basically.
Yes. Yes.
The moment anyone challenges that, it's like in a classroom. If you can convince the kids you're all powerful, they're terrified of you. But if they start pushing the boundaries enough, they get to the point where it's like, oh, she can't really do anything. And then it's fucking chaos. So the whole object of classroom management is to never let it get to that point by
right.
making it seem too scary to even try. There's another tip for you, listeners, if you're ever in that situation. But once those boundaries have been crossed, you know, once the Rubicon has been crossed and everyone sort of turns their heads and goes, what? Oh, nothing happened. Then that's not a boundary anymore. It's not a standard.
Yeah.
It's not a rule. It doesn't count.
Yeah.
And that's what happens time and time again. And every time we in the rational, real world based community think like, well, this is a line he couldn't possibly cross, right? Surely this is the one. It never turns out to be the one. No matter what happens, nothing happens. No matter what is revealed, they always deny it. And then when they can't deny it, they move the goalposts. They say it doesn't matter. Like, they're not even claiming that Trump didn't do all the things he's accused of doing. They're saying that's fine. That's
right.
That's what a president's supposed to do. He's supposed to ask a foreign government known to have corrupt prosecutors, to prosecute his political rival.
And at a certain point, like, aren't these people humiliated that this is their president? Aren't these people humiliated at how corrupt and dealing and like and the fact that Lev Parnas's lawyer has been like trolling on Twitter, like, let Lev speak, like, we're about to release all these texts where they're literally threatening to off an American
ambassador. But that's the thing. The firing of Yovanovitch, that was enough. That should have been enough. Like, a career diplomat, the most well-respected, high-regarded of people, worked for different administrations, different parties, was fighting corruption in Ukraine. That was her whole thing. And then there's a smear campaign, and the president fires her for no reason.
Yeah.
Right there, that's enough to
yeah.
be like, this is a corrupt president. This is not right. But nothing will ever be enough. That's the thing.
Yes.
And part of the reason it'll never be enough is the Democrats don't have the numbers and they don't have the ovaries, whatever, to really do something about it.
Right.
I'm still holding out hope. Like, I do think Nancy Pelosi knows what the fuck she's doing. So I'm not like pinning all my hopes on her and being like, she'll solve everything. But I'm going to withhold judgment until I see where she's going with this.
Well, and also I just keep, and I know I've brought this up before, I just keep being reminded of when they did that podcast about Watergate on Slate, Slow Burn, yeah, and they did a whole episode about conspiracy theories and how Trump saw the rise of conspiracy theories because, or Nixon saw the rise of conspiracy theories because your craziest ideas ended up all being true. It's like, at this point, it's like, yes, the country's run by lizard people. Like, it's like our craziest version of this story, of this unbelievable story, is true.
Yeah, I honestly think it will never matter because we talked about this. Like, we talked about the idea of Trump supporters as sort of having gone so far that they can never turn back, having committed themselves in a certain way, maybe even just by voting for him.
Well, and that's part of cults.
Yeah.
It's like,
yeah,
once you've committed, you have to be in because you've gone this far that you have to stay that far.
Yes. There's no pulling yourself out of that. And that may be because facing what you've done is so impossible.
Yeah.
So you just dig deeper and deeper. And a big part of that is also this culture war bullshit. That's really what it comes down to. I think for all of the analysis and hand-wringing and white liberals and publications like the New York Times desperately trying to figure out what's going on with these people and what is it that they want, when it comes down to it, Trump's their guy. He's their guy. You know, Ilhan Omar, she's not their guy.
Right.
She's something else. And Nancy Pelosi is something else. And those people are out to get them and their way of life. Or those people just don't like them, don't respect them, don't respect their way of life. But Trump's going to defend them against those people. He's going to own the libs.
Well, it's exhausting.
Consider me owned.
You know what else is exhausting?
Yes.
Double Standard Watch 2020.
2020.
Oh my God.
Here
so,
we go.
Here we go. Elizabeth Warren. She's a snake.
She's a liar.
Not only is she a liar, she's a liar about Bernie. How dare she?
How dare she? I know. So there's this whole thing going on basically last week. Someone from Warren's campaign probably leaked this information.
I don't think it was her.
I don't know about that. I honestly don't know. It's getting down to crunch time in Iowa. They're behind. Maybe they're getting desperate. I'm not saying it came from Liz, but it's totally possible that somebody on her campaign, some of her staffers, thought, you know, get this out there. I find that plausible. The thing that makes it more plausible is that once the story came out, the story being that at a private dinner that Sanders and Warren had in 2016, he said something to the effect of he didn't think a woman could be elected president.
Yeah.
And her statement in the aftermath was like, that was a private dinner. I'm not interested in talking about it. Yes, Bernie did say that, but that's not the point of this. Well, we've got to work together. It's like, oh, she didn't have to do that.
Right.
She didn't have to do that. She could have just said, I'm not going to talk about it. It was private.
Right.
And that really stoked the fires on Twitter anyway. The Bernie bots are back. The really hardcore stands. But look, I think a lot of them are Russian accounts. I'm not going to lie. Like,
sure. But also then you have other Bernie bots like fucking Michael Moore.
Oh my God.
Who in his new podcast, his latest episode is called The Sad Downfall of Elizabeth Warren. I just feel like, again, there is no way for a woman to win. When Hillary was running, everybody was like, well, if Elizabeth Warren was running, I'd vote for her. And now Elizabeth Warren is running and nobody wants to vote for her.
Nobody of those people who were saying, well, if Elizabeth Warren were running, none of them want to vote for her. And they never did. And we said that at the time and we were right.
Yep. That's it. So just back to Double Standard, that like everything becomes another reason why Elizabeth Warren is untrustworthy, not because she's ever done or ever said anything so untrustworthy, but because women are inherently untrustworthy. And so we are just always looking for the opportunity, always, always, to prove their untrustworthiness.
Yes, but especially when women are talking about sexism that they've observed.
Well, yeah, and we've talked about this before, but I feel like, again, when is the moment that we can call out sexism or racism in the moment? Because it always seems to be something that gets to be called out once it's happened. Once Kamala's out of the race, we go, God, you know, she dealt with a lot of racism and sexism. But when she's in the middle of it and anybody's like, there's some racism and sexism, people are like, oh, no.
The thing is, when you're running for something, in that specific situation, you can't talk about it.
Yes.
There is no possible way to talk about the discrimination you're experiencing as a candidate without sounding like you're whiny and positioning yourself as a victim and making excuses. You can't do it.
All right. Double Standard Watch.
2020. Okay, let's get to the fun stuff. We're going to talk about the Oscar nominations. Here's what I want to do. I want to go category by category.
All right.
And share our thoughts about why we think various people in films got nominated and others got snubbed.
Yep.
Keeping in mind, listeners, that this is going to be more about the sort of politics, not Democrat, Republican politics so much, but the sort of internal politics of Hollywood and the Academy and the factors that play into whether a film or performer or artist gets nominated, they're so much more than just the quality of the performance or the film.
And the reason that this is important is because even though Hollywood and media production and media delivery systems, and as we talked about with Kieran Scarlett on an earlier episode about tokenism in Hollywood, things are changing very rapidly, but the Oscars nominations and votes happen from other members of the Academy, all of whom are other people who've made movies. So like, Best Director is voted on by other directors. Best Actor is voted on by other actors.
Best Editor voted on by other editors.
Right. So what's important to remember is that these people are always going to be the old guard, because this is the collection of people who have joined the Academy over the past, whatever, 50 years, and they've remained members of the Academy. And the old guard still remains in many ways the gatekeeper to money, the gatekeepers to opportunity. And I feel like that's why it's interesting. It's interesting to see what these old gatekeepers, also because the Oscars are a self-reinforcing system.
Yes.
Like, the movies that get Oscar nominees and get recognized in this way are going to have another kind of life that they wouldn't otherwise have. So when you see what the gatekeepers sort of point to and are willing to recognize, it's still a really important window into the people making culture, even as we're at this very radical transitional point.
That was a very good justification for this use of our time. Also, it affects what movies get made and who gets to make them as
yes,
well.
That's right.
So all of that said, let's start with Best Picture.
Okay.
I want to talk about a couple things. Number one, Ford versus Ferrari. What the fuck is that? What the fuck?
What? I can't.
I don't know. I don't know. It's there. It's on the list. This is what happens when you open up the list to like, oh, we're going to have 10 nominees. It's like, okay, well, we need a 10th one.
Yeah, but Ford versus Ferrari, you know, the only people who have talked to me about liking that movie are like old guys.
Well, there you go.
So there
also,
you go.
We should keep in mind that the median age of Motion Picture Academy members is 117. It is a very old group and a very white group.
Yes.
You could definitely fit all of the people of color who are members of the Academy in my apartment. And I yes. live in New York City. So
yes. Yes.
Okay. We have to talk about The Irishman getting nominated for Best Picture, among others.
Okay, this is what I have to say about The Irishman. I know I've spoken about The Irishman before. I have to say, it is the movie that never should have been made, and nobody told Martin Scorsese how bad it is. It being nominated is basically the entire world. It's almost like The Truman Show or whatever. It's like,
sure, like The Emperor's New Clothes.
No one wants to tell him. No one wants to tell him.
No, it's nominated as a reflexive act. Like, I don't even know if anyone watched it, but Martin Scorsese made a movie. It's getting nominated for Best Picture and Best Director and probably a bunch of other stuff. It's going to happen. It's automatic. Joker, we're going to talk about later, I think, in a little more detail because I actually watched it. But that got nominated more than any other movie. It got like 11 nominations. Yeah, we'll talk about that. Little Women got nominated. Yay!
But, okay, here's the thing.
Yes.
I don't want to see Little Women either. nobody wants to see Little Women, and I don't either. But let me tell you why. It's because I actually fucking love the book Little Women. And because of that, I have never been able to watch any film adaptation of Little Women. It's like a film adaptation of Jane Eyre. It cannot happen for me. And I feel like that's part of the problem, is that the people who that movie is made for are the people who also are like, I cannot see a movie adaptation of this book.
That's an interesting take. I hear it's very good and different from other adaptations of Little Women, which I'm all for. But what we have to talk about is that it did not get nominated for Best Director.
Nope. It got nominated for so many categories. It got nominated for Best Picture, Best Screenplay, Best this, Best that, and somehow no Best Director. Right. I wonder why.
I wonder why. Well, remember how we talked about how directors vote on who's going to get nominated for Best Director?
Uh-huh.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
In the director category, we have Martin Scorsese, Todd Phillips for Joker, Sam Mendes for 1917. It's supposed to be good. Quentin Tarantino for Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. We'll talk about that in a second. And Bong Joon-ho for Parasite, which I'm somewhat surprised to see in the Best Director category.
Oh, he should win. Oh, that movie should win. That movie should just win everything. Oh, it's so good.
So, of course, you only have 5 slots for Best Director, despite the, I don't know, infinite slots for Best Picture, so that somebody's not going to get nominated. I'm somewhat gratified that Greta Gerwig's husband, Noah Baumbach, did not get nominated for directing Marriage Story, because that would have fucking sucked.
Yes.
At least they both got snubbed. But yeah, okay, Martin Scorsese is going to get nominated. That's a given. He farted. He's going to get fucking nominated, right? Tarantino's going to get nominated.
We're going to talk about that.
We're going to talk about that. Apparently 1917, I haven't seen it. It's a World War I picture. So already it's in Oscar territory because it's like historical drama, war picture. It's got all that stuff. It's shot and edited so as to appear to be one single take.
Right. And I feel like that's the sort of like big balls move that's going to get recognized.
Or what you might call gimmick. But yeah, I haven't seen the movie, so I don't want to judge.
But no, but it's also this thing where it's like the only woman who's ever won Best Director, Kathryn Bigelow, makes very like male movies.
Oh, yeah.
And that's the thing. It's like, so Greta Gerwig made a movie that's by all accounts quite brilliantly directed, but it's about ladies. So it can't be, it can't really show skill.
Exactly. But look at who's nominating. It's a lot of dudes. It's director dudes. They have a very specific idea of what they think is storytelling. And are worthwhile stories
but also,
to be told.
What connotes excellence?
Right.
And I think that here I have to talk about the entire shutout of Hustlers. The entire shutout for that movie, which I finally watched last week. It's shocking. It's shocking.
Yeah. It's a good movie? I haven't seen it.
And you know what? It's like the fucking Republicans. All the things they say they want is not really what they want. What they want to do is protect what they have. Yeah. And it's the same with Hustlers. Hustlers is the movie that The Big Short wanted to be.
Oh, interesting.
Except it was really so much better. It was so well directed. It was like every shot was perfect. It's so fucking good. And it was not seen at all. Okay, so this is what I was tweeting yesterday, and okay. This brings us back to Scorsese. Hustlers is like a feminist Big Short or a feminist Wolf of Wall Street. And both of those movies got nominated when they were up that year because they were big, splashy movies that were about the economic boom and bust. Mm-hmm. And so they were relevant. They were, you know, they were kind of beautiful. They were really smart. But because Hustlers is about women going through this experience, it's like it's fucking invisible. But every shot of Hustlers is like a director at her, like, you're like, oh, you just want to kiss your fingers like an Italian chef. You're like, mwah. Laureen Scafaria is like, oh shit, you have skill. Like, there are shots in that movie where I'm like, oh God, how did you even think of
that? It didn't make a gazillion dollars. And it isn't a director that everybody knows and knows they have to nominate. And it's women.
If Hustlers had been made by a man, which it couldn't have been the movie that it was, if it had been made by a man, ugh.
Okay, once upon a time in Hollywood. So we did a whole episode on Tarantino and that movie. And I think we continue to somewhat disagree on how much we like the film.
Yes.
But it's an inevitability that this would be nominated. And it is the one I think will win Best Picture.
I have to share at this point a series of texts I had from my best friend, Nikki, right after the QT episode came out. She sends me this text and she says this. Proposition. QT centered aging white men in Hollywood being faced with their own obsolescence in his latest film because this is still who makes up the majority of Oscar voters.
Yep.
I mean, it's such a cynical take on why he would make that movie. And she said, keep in mind, he has only been nominated for a Best Director Oscar twice in his career, and he's never won.
Never won.
She says, it's about reminding the majority of Oscar voters, either literally or figuratively, of that beautiful time when their dicks still worked. A working dick plus encroaching irrelevance. And she says,
exactly.
She says, it's okay, Pop, you're Brad Pitt, just nobody realizes it.
I think we need to say no more. I mean,
that's it. That's why he made the movie, and he played the game.
Yep.
And he's going to win the game because of it.
And he will. And as a general rule, the Academy loves any movie that's about movies. They love movies that are about Hollywood, about the magic of movies, and so forth. The notable exception being La La Land not winning, but that was the year that Hollywood had to prove it wasn't racist. Moonlight win. They had to. But now they've done that. They've got that out of the way, and they can forget about all that having to not be racist stuff. And anything that's Hollywood on Hollywood, they're just, they love that shit.
Yeah.
I also think that Tarantino will win Best Director because of that, and also because he's never won it, and he has this body of work. And he has sort of transitioned from being that young, up-and-coming maker of quirky, weird films that are just a little too offbeat for the Academy.
But he's gone from being that young punk.
Yeah.
With his, like, arrogance and his brashness and all that stuff.
Right. Now he's an established, what would you call it? He's an established establishment.
I mean, he's an establishment figure. He's like one of the greats. He's like, and he's on their side.
Right, exactly.
He's on the side of whiteness and maleness.
Exactly.
He stopped messing around with, like, using the N-word and wanting to be black. It's like,
he's still doing that, but he left it aside for this movie. So.
For that, well, yeah, because at the end of the day, what he wants is to just appreciate and win based on his privilege.
Exactly. Okay. Another category that I want to discuss is lead actress.
Okay.
Because, interestingly, Cynthia Erivo, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, was nominated for Harriet, which, if I'm not mistaken, was the only nomination Harriet got.
Yep.
So that's very telling, I think.
Oh, it got Best Original Song.
Oh, okay. All right. That barely counts, but okay.
Yeah,
It's a thing. So, again, we had our Oscars so white moment, and then we had the Oscars showing that they were really trying to change, and now it's this like, oh, they made a movie about Harriet Tubman? Okay, well, nominate the lady that played her. There you go. We nominated Harriet Tubman. It's done.
Yes. We didn't nominate the actress. We nominated the historical figure of Harriet Tubman.
Exactly. We're not going to overlook Harriet Tubman now.
That's right.
Of course.
That's right.
That would be racist.
God, and oh, God, it's the only person of color in any of the acting categories.
That's true. Oh, my God, that's true.
It, and this was a year where, like, Lupita Nyong'o played two parts in Us and was...
Oh, my God, that's right.
Brilliant. This was the year where I watched Hustlers. J-Lo was fucking fantastic, and I have never understood her appeal ever. Mm. Like, she's beautiful and all that, but I've never understood, like, J-Lo, why?
I love her.
She is amazing in that movie. Amazing.
She just always has this glow. I don't know. It's her grooming. She brings it. She presents herself. I really respect it.
But in the movie, she's also fan fucking tastic. And, like, everybody was sure, like, this is it. This is J-Lo's right. Oscar.
No, not even close.
Mm-mm.
So in the lead actress category, yeah, it's all white ladies. Renee Zellweger for Judy, Charlize Theron for Bombshell. Those are two cases very common where they play a real person. So they've got to do the makeup and the persona and sort of make you believe they are that person. So that's like a guaranteed nomination. Scarlett Johansson in Marriage Story is very much like a... Well, we thought you were boobs, but look at you.
Look at you acting.
Yeah.
And she also got nominated for supporting actress for Jojo Rabbit.
Oh, which is interesting because I don't want to say she's bad in that, but her German accent is so sad. Why just let people speak in their natural accents?
Just give the nomination spot to J-Lo. Like, that's what you should have. Just give it to J-Lo.
Supporting actor, Al Pacino, Joe Pesci, both for The Irishman.
I can't, it's so embarrassing. Like, I'm embarrassed for them. Like, it's so bad. Like,
again, they could fart. They're going to get nominated. They were in a Scorsese movie. It's going to happen regardless. Again, Tom Hanks. I feel like Tom Hanks wakes up in the morning, he gets nominated for an Oscar. Like, that's going to happen.
But here's the thing that I want to say.
Okay.
So Little Women gets nominated for everything except director, because we're not going to nominate the lady. Parasite gets nominated for everything except actors, because
we're not going to nominate speaking performances.
No, but it's very rare. But it's rare, except in the case when, like, the movie is acknowledged as, because a lot of times best foreign film kind of stays in its lane of just its category. And occasionally there's a foreign film that gets so recognized that it's also being in the best screenplay category, the best film category, as Parasite was.
Yeah.
But the actors who were brilliant, no one. And maybe it's because it's such a strong ensemble cast, but still, those actors were genius. No
one
got
it. They were all wonderful. I do think the ensemble cast has something to do with it. In the rare cases where a foreign language performance is nominated for an acting award, I think it's typically a movie that's, like, carried by that one performance.
Mm.
Where it's, like, all about that performance. Or maybe it's an actor who's known to Americans, or both. I just want to talk briefly. Okay, the rest of the categories are the shit that no one's seen the animated shorts, no one's seen the documentary short subjects. Adapted screenplay and original screenplay. These are categories very dear to my heart.
Because those are the categories where they always stick the people who really are the best film.
Yep.
Except they're not going to let them be the best film.
Original screenplay is for the movie that really is the best one, but it's too weird or challenging or whatever to be best picture. Not always, but a lot of the time that's been true. In fact, Pulp Fiction won best original screenplay, for
that's
example.
That's absolutely right.
So it's not shocking that Parasite would be nominated, though the fact that it's foreign language script is pretty impressive. Marriage Story is going to win that for that reason. Yeah, because they want to honor that movie, but what else are they going to give it? And with adapted screenplay, it's interesting because adapted screenplay is more often traditionally, historically, given to the movie that does win Best Picture. Things have changed in recent years. I wonder if Joker will get adapted screenplay, or maybe Jojo Rabbit, as the, like, we should recognize this film, but we're not going to give it Best Picture thing.
We'll see.
Actually, Little Women has a good chance at that, now that
it's not going to be Little Women.
You
it's not going to
so?
Be Little Women.
See, I think Little Women, because the nominations are voted on by the people in that category. Screenwriters nominate screenwriters, but then the entire Academy votes on the actual awards. And I think when you're looking at the entire ballot, there's a like, oh, well, we got to give Greta Gerwig something. This is like a way to say, we respect women directors. We love what she did. We're just not going to give her Best Picture or Best Director or anything like that.
Right.
I think she has a really good chance at that one.
We'll see.
And then maybe Once Upon a Time in Hollywood gets original screenplay because it's going to be Best Picture. Let's talk about Best Documentary Short Subject. Just kidding. We haven't seen any of those. Let's be real. I wanted to talk about the visual effects category.
Okay.
Just because The Irishman is nominated for Best Visual Effects.
Oh my God, it's so embarrassing. It's like, we are all like, it's the Emperor's New Clothes. Like, no, it's so
Imagine
bad.
Imagine if The Irishman wins Best Visual Effects and nothing else.
That would be so amazing. That would be
Fingers
the only
crossed.
Thing that's okay.
Yeah.
Like, because that would be like, God, that would be
that
like
would
the
be
biggest
funny.
Troll of all time. That would be the biggest troll of all time.
That's all I'm saying. Okay, let's talk about Joker.
All right. Now, we're each going to talk about a movie that one of us has seen and the other one. No, you did see Parasite.
I did see Parasite. That's right.
Okay. Talk about
but
Joker.
I'm going to talk about Joker, which only I've seen. I just wanted to take this opportunity because Joker was nominated for more Oscars than any other movie this year. Like, Best Picture, Best Director, Best Actor, right?
Yeah.
And it's a little bit baffling. So why? Why? What's going on here? I broke down and I was like, I guess I should just watch this fucking movie. And I watched it. And here's what I have to say. It's not good. Now, I'm not saying it's bad. It's just not good. It's fine. It has some good stuff in it. I would say, first of all, it's too fucking long, and it's really quite ponderous at points. Like, it drags. It doesn't have a strong through line in terms of a central question.
Like, what's the fable? What's the spine of this story?
Yeah.
The basic thing
you learn in Screenwriting 101, like, you open Sid Field and page one is like, there has to be a central question. Is the character going to achieve his goal? Is he going to stop the villain from doing his thing? Is the mystery going to get solved? Who killed the butler? Like, whatever it is, there's a question. And you keep watching because you want to know the answer. And that kind of doesn't exist until exactly 50 minutes into this movie. I know that because I was watching it on the treadmill. And like, so I knew exactly what minute it was. And I was like, wow, 50 minutes into this movie, it starts to pick up. So okay, I'm not doing spoilers yet. I'm just going to say, if you haven't seen Joker, as a comic book movie, as like, here's a fun, dark, gritty, different idea for the origin of the Joker.
Right.
It's not bad. It's okay. It's a little too long and it gets boring in parts, but it's worth watching on that level. I happen to really be inclined towards stories like that. I love the, like, let's look at things from the villain's point of view or the peripheral character's point of view, you know, taking right. a story you're totally familiar with and
making it new,
putting it through someone else's eyes. I love that. So on that level, it's perfectly competent. Yes, it's derivative. Every single thing you see in it is something you've already seen in another movie. Every single right. thing. It's borrowing from Taxi Driver, but like also a million other things. But it's fairly entertaining on that level. And if you're a comic book fan or just generally a Batman fan, it's good on that level. Joaquin Phoenix's performance in it, which is what everyone's like so excited about. I don't know. It was fine. I'm not so impressed by someone playing insanity. But if they were playing it in a way that felt to me like, wow, this is a real exploration of mental illness, I might be impressed.
Right.
This movie was giving you every signal that it's a real exploration of mental illness, but it's not. It's not. He's mentally ill. He's on all these different drugs. Okay, now I think I might get into spoilers. So if you haven't seen it and you don't want it spoiled, I'm going to be spoiling it now. You're supposed to understand that society has abandoned him because the city program where he sees a therapist and gets his medication gets defunded, and then he no longer has the support system, except at that point in the movie, he has already literally murdered 3 people and then got an erection from it. I'm like, I don't know what the meds are doing for him at this point.
Is this a story about class? What does class do to already completely psychotic cartoon villains?
It is about class, but it doesn't know what the fuck it's saying about class. And I think that's why people like it when it comes down to it, because you can read it however you want. You can read it as a story about what happens when society abandons the neediest and most vulnerable people. Or you can read it as what happens when people blame others for their problems and, you know, think that everything that goes wrong is society's fault. You can approach it from all these different perspectives and get what you want. Like the Joker, yeah, he kills these 3 Wall Street guys. I'm like, okay, I'm with you. You got me, movie. The Joker kills these 3 Wall Street guys because they're sexually harassing this woman on the train. And I'm like, oh, it's like a reverse Bernie Getz kind of thing.
Right,
and,
right.
And then this sort of movement starts in the city. It's Gotham, right? Not New York, where people start wearing clown masks because all they know about the murderer is that he was dressed as a clown because that was his job in the movie. And they start wearing clown masks and holding up signs that say resist, which is kind of pointed. And Thomas Wayne, whom we know as Bruce Wayne's father, is running for mayor. And he says that people shouldn't blame the rich and hate the rich. And Thomas Wayne is kind of an asshole in this. And you're definitely supposed to not like him. But then you're definitely also not supposed to be happy when he and his wife are killed. Spoiler alert, Batman's right, parents get
right,
killed.
Right, right.
And that's like, that was the main thing that kept me going through the movie. I was like, are Martha Wayne's pearls going to fly in the air? That's all I want to see. At some right. point, this is going to culminate with Martha Wayne's pearl necklace getting torn off, because you can't have a Batman movie or Batman yes, universe movie
that's
without
right.
that happening.
That's right.
And look, listeners, I won't spoil it that much for you. You'll just have to watch and find out if that happens. But they do get killed. And yeah, you could read it as being a condemnation of the way the Joker blames society for his problems, and it leads everything into chaos.
Uh-huh.
There's no clear, and I don't want movies to spell shit out for me, but I think they're just throwing shit up there to try to seem like they're relevant and
here's the thing,
making some kind of commentary.
I think that you know the difference and you can feel the difference when there is a as sort of a world, like the sort of world behind it, the structure of the world, where yes. the makers of the movie don't tell you, but they know. You know what I mean?
Oh, absolutely.
And when they just really have no idea.
Yeah.
Like, and I think that you know that. I think you know that when you're like, the internal logic of this world is sound. And all of a sudden I'm reminded of Harry Potter and the fact that apparently J.K. Rowling has like notebooks and notebooks about the backstory of every single like student in that school whose name you've heard mentioned once.
Yeah.
She really knows her world. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but I'm not going to say there's a tight internal logic to everything in the Harry Potter world.
No. But there's a way that like whatever the logic is, the creator has it.
Right.
Maybe they can't always articulate all of it to others, but they know it's there.
Absolutely.
And then there are things where you're like, this story was built by committee.
Well, I will say I don't think that was the issue. It wasn't that it felt written by committee, and it wasn't that it felt like they didn't know the world they were trying to create. Like the world they're trying to create, they clearly established the idea that it's really hard times. It's hard times. People
right.
are out of work. They're frustrated.
Right.
Like, it's like the 70s in New York or early 80s in New York. It's really what it is. It's Donald Trump's fevered fantasy of what the early 80s were like in New York. Do you know what I mean? I mean, the movie
right.
opens with like a gang of youths beating up the protagonist. It makes a lot of pointed references to real things from the news in the past and present
okay.
in ways that I feel aren't necessarily done by committee, but are definitely done for the sake of doing it. Sort of like, this is a thing that really happened, so let's put it in here without giving a great deal of thought to why or how or what it means.
Right.
For example, you find out late in the movie, we are in spoiler zone here, people, that the Joker's stepfather beat him terribly when he was a young kid and left him tied to a radiator. That was a news story. I remember this being a story where an abused kid was found tied to a radiator. They wanted to have that shock and that resonance, but it's not clear to what end. It sort of seems to be like ultimately they're saying the world is shitty and people are shitty and everything's shitty. There you go. And it's all just going to wind up in chaos. The people who are doing the protesting and holding up the resist signs wind up becoming a riot mob. Literally, they start rioting the city, burning shit, and they become this mob supporting the Joker as he steps into his role as Joker. And they're cheering him on, which no matter what you know about the Batman universe, at that point in the movie, you understand this as a bad turn of events.
Yes.
He has fomented violence.
But that's the thing. I mean, what you're describing sounds to me like it's one of those movies that ultimately is like punching down, because what it really wants to assert is that order in the form of wealth is like the way that it needs to go.
Kind of.
Ultimately, that sounds like super reactionary.
I agree. But it's really easy to have not that reading of it. And again, I'm not opposed to a movie that has various ways into it, various ways to think about it. I don't want all my answers to be pat, and I don't want movies to hammer me over the head with what their message is. But this one is hammering you over the head with the idea that it's socially relevant and maybe politically relevant, that it's saying something, but it's not. And the portrayal of mental illness is seriously problematic. Like, it's nice that they show this idea that he got his services taken away from him, because that did happen in the 80s. Reagan did cut funding for mental health programs, and a lot of people
yes.
wound up on the streets. But most people who are mentally ill don't become violent. The huge, huge majority of people who are mentally ill are not violent. But
right.
of course, he becomes violent. So it's like, I don't know. I can't look at this movie as being actually an intelligent, worthwhile exploration of mental health issues. It's not an intelligent, worthwhile exploration of social issues or economic inequality. It's just kind of a fun idea to think about how maybe some guy became the Joker because he had a job as a clown And then he went crazy. How is this nominated for 11 Oscars?
You know what? I think this is like a great time to then talk about Parasite, which as a parable of class is fucking outrageously brilliant. I know we're here to ruin things that people love. I am not ruining Parasite.
Let's end on this positive note because Parasite's great and actually makes a really interesting contrast with Joker.
Absolutely.
Not least of which because the Joker, the character Arthur Fleck, has a condition where he laughs uncontrollably as part of his mental condition.
Okay.
And without spoilers, actually is something that comes into play in Parasite.
Wait, when?
At the end.
Oh, oh my God. Okay. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's amazing. That's amazing. But also like Parasite, it's actually also interesting to think about it in terms of Hustlers. There are all of these movies that are trying to talk about class and wealth and the people who don't have access to wealth, the people who don't have access to class in that certain way. Mm-hmm. And I feel like Hustlers gets at the emotional reality of it. Joker is trying to do something. Parasite,
yes,
to me, is like gets to a level of giant metaphor and archetype where every moment of it manages to be rich with complicated meaning without being heavy-handed in any way. Every beat of it is like, oh God, that hurts. That like that cuts in so many directions. That's so revelatory about what things are like. It's so metaphorical. It's so archetypal. And yet it manages to still feel so kind of like effortless. Mm-hmm. And so like it's not banging it in your head with meaning. It's just there. It's like poetry. It's like I was describing it to a friend, like it's like when you reduce a sauce so that it really gets the essence of that sauce.
That's what poetry is. Poetry is the essence. It's language that is distilled down to its essence.
And I feel like Parasite was a poem of class difference, except it was meaningful and it knew what it was saying. Yeah. It wasn't like, let's throw it out there. And it does it without making any of the characters heroes or villains.
That's one of the most beautiful things about it. It works completely on the level of just a sort of dark comedy drama about people.
Yes.
And their relationships and schemes. And it doesn't demonize anyone. No one is one-dimensional.
And yet it's a parable. And yet it's this very like damning, sort of unsparing parable about class in this moment that we're living in. And when I left, it's very rare that I feel like this, where I leave a movie theater and I feel like I'm on drugs, where I just feel like everything looks really different right now, where it's like my brain feels like it's been taken off of my head and sort of scrubbed and put back on. Also, in terms of best director, it is so beautifully shot. Oh my God.
It is really a beautiful movie.
Oh my God. Every shot of that movie is so good. Oh my God.
It hit home for me a lot because I tutor a number of well-to-do students from well-to-do families. And so early in the movie, it starts with the kids from the poorer family getting tutoring jobs with the wealthier family. And I was like, wow, this is like so true. Everything that's happening is so true.
Everything that's happening right now is like, and I'm not going to have a spoiler about, but I have to say the sex scene with the parents.
Yeah. Yeah. I know what you mean. I know.
Just, oh my God. So I feel like the fact that Parasite at least got recognized outside of the best foreign film category, which so rarely happens. To me, that's like the one thing. It was actually recognized as its greatness outside of just being like a Korean movie.
Yeah. And that's wonderful. It's really lovely. And it's an unexpected movie to be getting that kind of recognition. I'm not sure what about it struck such a note that the Academy would take note of it. It's a wonderful movie. I really enjoyed it, but it is somewhat surprising, but refreshing that the Academy has responded so positively. Yes, Maya's shrugging. Who can say?
Who can say? We've gone on too long.
Yeah, well, you gotta cut it all out.
We'll get it down.
And then you'll go to our Patreon, patreon.com/saucepodcast.
And you'll pay your money down every month so that you can get all of the minisodes that are going to come out of this very long conversation that we just had.
Yes, we get sidetracked, but who doesn't love extra sauce?
Exactly. And we will get to the culture of the garbage dumpster fire that is our current politic soon.
Soon.
But we're going to have to drink so much more. How drunk are you? We haven't drunk-o-metered.
Okay, drunk-o-meter. I feel like I'm like a 3, but I had 2 of these and it's like a whole big martini glass. So how are you?
I'm kind of at a 5, but also, and please cut this out, I feel like...
Oh, I won't.
Is this alcohol or is this just premenstrualness? You know what I mean? Those times when you don't even know what your body is doing right now.
Yeah. It's just... Things fluctuate.
Just deeply hormonal right now. So who's to say what's alcohol and what's hormones? I certainly can't.
Does your period make you high? Because I'd like to know about that.
Well, this is not the time to talk about perimenopause, but shit is weird. Shit is just weird.
Everything goes in different directions and you
just
never know what to
expect.
It's
just very strange.
It's a menstrual thrill ride. Okay. Listeners, thank you so much for joining us. We want to hear from you. We want to hear your thoughts and your predictions about the Oscars.
We want to hear about what you would like us to ruin next, which we will be happy to do. We know we are way overdue on Watchmen.
Have you finished watching it?
No, that's next. I've been catching up.
You have nothing to do all day. Just watch it.
I'm making art, okay?
My art is watching HBO series. That's my art.
All right.
Reach out to us. You can email us. We are saucepodcast@gmail.com. You can reach us on the Twitter and Instagram as @saucepodcast. You can reach me, Rebecca, as @gynostar on all the various platforms.
You can reach me at Maya Garanz anywhere you are looking for Maya Garanzes.
And again, don't forget to visit our Patreon at patreon.com/saucepodcast, where there's bonus material if you want to participate and join and become a member.
All right. See you next week.
Adios, amoebas.